high end of any error bars in climate models, the higher numbers in the estimates. Remember that when you read papers. And finally, it is possible, as Hansen and a few others insist, that climate sensitivity is greater than we previously thought. That means we warm faster with less carbon dioxide and methane added to the atmosphere. If true, this is as serious as a heart attack.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The now retired from NASA James Hansen is not very retired. He continues to publish papers with other scientists, but does so through his Columbia University blog without peer review. Hansen prefers to work on his own, often outside the general global scientific community. In recent work, Hansen claimed global warming was accelerating and insinuated mainstream science missed it. Experts like Michael Mann from PenU were critical, saying recent warming was still within the error bars or upper limits predicted by formal groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now there is new support for heat acceleration, predicted or not. Stefan Rahmstorf has a preprint paper titled Global Warming Has Accelerated Significantly. That was posted March 3rd, 2025, and now there is a revised version June 8th. As always, you can find links in my blog. Rahmstorf is not part of the usual James Hansen team of authors. Stefan is a German oceanographer and climatologist, a longtime professor of physics of the oceans at Potsdam University. He is also head of the research department at PIC, the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Rahmstorf is well known in the community for his authoritative posts at the blog realclimate.org. I will read you from the abstract in their new unpublished as yet paper. Recent record hot years have caused a discussion whether global warming has accelerated, but previous analysis found the acceleration has not yet reached a 95% confidence level, given the natural temperature variability. Here we account for the influence of three main natural variability factors: El Niño, volcanism, and solar variation. The resulting adjusted data shows that after 2015, global temperature rose significantly faster than in any previous 10-year period since 1945. That was a quote from Stefan Rahmstorf, and it's in a not-yet-published paper. Basically, there are five major computing centers storing global observations of temperature that have been collected in both land and sea. They are operated by NASA, NOAA, the Hadley Center for Climate Research in the UK, Berkeley, and the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. Each has slightly different figures for the end of 2024 warming over pre-industrial. The average from all of them is 1.46 degrees C of warming, barely under the 1.5 degree Paris Climate Accord, supposedly the safety line that we should never cross. The European Center says we already crossed 1.5 degrees C in 2024. Every other model predicts this will happen in 2026, next year. Across all observation sets, we appear to be warming by 0.43 degrees C per decade. Just for comparison, the global average surface temperature has risen at an average rate of 0.17 C per decade since 1901. So Earth is warming four times faster than in the previous century. Dutch amateur scientist Leon Simons created a handy chart to see where this goes. It assumes no further acceleration of warming, just heating up at our current rate of 0.43 C per decade. In Simon's chart, the world crosses the dangerous 2 degrees C threshold in 2037. It is 2.5 degrees C hotter in 2048, which is crazy hot very soon within the lives of most of you listening. 3 degrees C comes in 2060. And an astonishing 3.5 degrees C in 2072, still within the lives of young people today. That is absolutely civilization crashing temperatures. Somewhere between 2054 and 2065, Earth might be 3 degrees C hotter. And that is 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit on a global average, mind you. A lot of experts believe civilization could not survive the climate emerging from that level of heat. Maybe a billion people would have to leave the overheated tropics. Crops would fail with all that means for social stability. Add in storms supercharged by hotter oceans. We might need a new Cat 6 or even more to describe them. Canadian systems scientist Paul Beckwith has a good YouTube video out, posted June 10th, also titled, Global Warming Has Accelerated Significantly. You can see Leon Simon's chart there. Look for Paul H. Beckwith on YouTube, or find the link in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. These heating projections do not include possible tipping points that could speed things up even faster. It does not even include any further acceleration. This one-lifetime jump in heat is based only on current observations taken from weather buoys, land stations, and satellites, and it reflects greenhouse gases we have already pushed into the atmosphere. So there's nothing, you know, theoretical about that. You don't need a model. Nothing in the future is guaranteed. A chain of volcanoes erupting for years could temporarily cool Earth. But when they stop, if they stop, and their ash is washed out by the rain, then true warming returns with a vengeance. The same is true if humans inject sulfates into the atmosphere, geoengineering. If that program stops, for war or pestilence or any other reason, the real warming appears very quickly. Or we could be hit with an asteroid, if you want to count on that. That changes everything. Those are long shots, aren't they? Realists know we are in a climate emergency. No matter what wars and hatred run through our minds, no matter what the TV screens show, no matter what we believe or do not believe, climate change is happening. We can respond and try and save ourselves and the other species, or we can live in a last great big party of frivolous pyre of burning carbon. It is our choice.
Radio EcoShock.
Let's look at new science showing more severe droughts will develop as we heat the planet. According to the latest from the EU Science Center Copernicus, it has been an exceptionally dry spring in parts of northwestern Europe. More droughts are popping up all over the world, from Africa through Asia. In some years, severe drought hit the U.S. southeast and main crop-growing regions in the U.S. and Russia. Talk about Australia, they can tell you about droughts. Drinking water can run out. And meanwhile, AI data farms, gas electricity plants, and nuclear reactors all have to shut down without enough cooling water. Outside these human affairs, animals suffer and die. Plant communities may die off in the drought to be replaced with more tolerant invader species. The insect world, an essential fungi change. You can't show drought in news video. It's not big on social media. People aren't talking about this, but increasing drought can change the world. And we also have reports on science of flash droughts. A severe drying of the soil can occur within days when the air is hot, dry, and thirsty. Plants wilt or dry. In the right conditions, a flash drought can develop just days after rain has fallen. I covered flash droughts with Brian Ansell from Texas Tech University in my show published April 20th, 2022. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. A new paper, June 4th in Nature, has the big picture on drought. The title is Warming Accelerates Global Drought Severity. The lead author is Solomon Gabrichalkis. He is research associate at Oxford School of Geography and the Environment. Solomon edits three climate science journals. He has dozens of papers on hydrology, the study of how water moves around on this planet. I spoke with Solomon, but technical problems plagued the recording. I'm going to quickly summarize our conversation and the new paper. The abstract is pretty clear, quote, drought is one of the most common and complex natural hazards affecting the environment, economies, and populations globally. However, there are significant uncertainties in global drought trends and a limited understanding of the extent to which a key driver, atmospheric evaporative demand, or AED, impacts the recent evolution of the magnitude, frequency, duration, and aerial extent of drought. Here, by developing an ensemble of high-resolution global drought data sets for 1901 to 2022, we find an increasing trend in drought severity worldwide. Our findings suggest that AED, the atmospheric evaporative demand, has increased drought severity by an average of 40% globally. Not only are typically dry regions becoming drier, but also wet areas are experiencing drying trends. During the past 5 years, 2018 to 2022, the areas in drought have expanded by 74% on average, compared with 1981 to 2017, with AED contributing 58% of this increase. The year 2022 was record-breaking, with 30% of the global land area affected by moderate and extreme droughts, 42% of which was attributed to increased AED. Our findings indicate that AED has an increasingly important role in driving severe droughts, and that this tendency will likely continue under future warming scenarios. That was a quote from the abstract for the June 4th paper in Nature, Warming Accelerates Global Drought Severity. In May, I interviewed Stanford's David Lobel about crop loss. Water vapor deficit was cited as a major driver of crop loss in the United States. In the new Nature paper looking at short droughts 6 months or less, they found a serious drying trend in Europe, Africa, Western North America, and South America. Some regions do get wetter in Southeast Asia, the Caribbean coast of South America, parts of Africa, and Eastern North America. So it's a mixed bag. I've assembled quotes from the paper relevant to drought in Europe, home to 750 million people. Quote, in Europe, 82% of land experienced drought, with 50% under moderate to severe drought. In 2022, annual precipitation across Europe dropped by up to 35%, below the 1981-2022 average, and AED increased by up to 40%. They also say, the year 2022 specifically was a record-breaking year for drought severity and extent in Europe and East Africa. In Europe, the severity of the 2022 drought event can be largely attributed to anthropogenic warming, as the anomalies observed in stream flow and soil moisture cannot be explained by the precipitation deficit alone, but mostly by enhanced AED, which increased water losses by evaporation. They continue, moreover, the ecological drought severity recorded in Europe's natural forests cannot be fully explained without considering the influence of high temperatures and AED on plant physiology. In the absence of formal attribution studies in other regions of the world that experienced the drought in 2022, the attribution in Europe and the increase in severity globally driven by enhanced AED suggests that it is reasonable to conclude anthropogenic global warming likely contributed to exacerbate global drought severity in 2022. In that year of 2022, European drought contributed to enhanced tree mortality, increased forest fires, and long-term soil moisture decline. So says the new paper in Nature, and Solomon led that paper. Well, let's look at the overall picture here. For years, some scientists suggested we should talk about global wetting instead of global warming. According to physics, the warmer atmosphere should suck up a lot more moisture. Whether the air reaches that capacity for water vapor varies greatly in different times and seasons and continents. That is why Solomon and other scientists can still warn about more extreme drought for some parts of the world, despite the atmosphere being able to hold more water vapor. Watching repeated triple-digit heat waves, we might think extreme heat is the villain killing crops. But the authors found a more serious threat. It is vapor pressure deficit. It often happens during high heat. The air can hold much more water than it does. The dry atmosphere tries to suck moistures from plants and from the soil. That, rather than heat, may be the true cause of crop damage. I look at this like a gardener. Suppose there is a good season with enough rain, and then a 3-week drought hits. It's really severe. And then it rains again. But if I do not have irrigation or enough water in my hose, the garden dies in that short burst of drought. A lot of plants don't come back. We lose food. Multiply that times all the rain-dependent crops around the world, and you see the problem. Drought can be a game-changer. Repeated droughts drive people out, lead to mass migration, even if the official annual rainfall has not changed. It's very strange. In our conversation, Solomon told me the area affected by drought has expanded significantly, particularly in the last 5 years. About a quarter of the land between 50 degrees south and 50 degrees north experienced drought in the last 5 years. That is 74% higher than during the period 1981-2017. Those are mind-crushing changes. You know about heat waves. Get ready for thirst waves. It's time to talk about Europe's cold shift, even in a time of global warming. At least a dozen times I've interviewed scientists on this program about the weakening ocean current that carries tropical heat to Ireland, the UK, Northern Europe, Scandinavia. You can call it the Gulf Stream or the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. Measurements of flow show that the warm current is getting weaker as the world warms. And we know that is partly the result of melting glaciers on Greenland. Exhaustive studies of previous ages show that this AMOC current can completely break down and almost stop flowing. The AMOC current appears to have a so-called tipping point where the process of shutdown begins and cannot be reversed. Humans cannot change this giant ocean current. Well, we do change it by heating up the atmosphere, but there is no way to change it with geoengineering. And what would it be like? Physicist René Van Westen has just published a new paper with a vision of Europe after the Gulf Stream collapse. René told Carbon Brief, "If the AMOC collapses, we need to prepare for substantially cooler winters. Winter extremes will be very substantial for some regions. Temperatures could go down to minus 50 degrees C in Scandinavia." End quote from René. Along with the new geophysical research letter by Van Westen and Michel Batassin, there is an interactive map they've published. You can tour the weather in Oslo or Dublin in the new cold regime after the collapse, whenever that may be. The paper published June 11th is titled "European Temperature Extremes Under Different AMOC Scenarios in the Community Earth System Model." Quoting again from Carbon Brief, June 11, 2025, the study suggests that, in an intermediate emissions scenario, greenhouse gas-driven warming would not be able to outweigh the cooling impact of an AMOC collapse. In this modeled world, 1 in 10 winters in London could see cold extremes approaching minus 20 degrees centigrade. Winter extremes in Oslo, Norway, meanwhile, could plummet to around minus 48 degrees centigrade. The cold temperatures are projected to be driven by the loss of heat transfer from the tropics via ocean currents, as well as the spread of sea ice to northern Europe in winter months. The research does not look at when AMOC might tip. Instead, it focuses on scenarios in the far future when this has already happened, so as to explore what impact it would have. And that's a quote from Carbon Brief. Here's a short clip from the BBC recorded May 1st, 2025. It's at the European Geosciences Union Conference in Vienna. Correspondent Roland Peace talks with Professor Stefan Rahmstorf about AMOC collapse.
But there is one topic I really wanted to get to. That's the future of our climate, in particular, a debate that we've been covering on Science and Action that's sharpening over whether changes in Atlantic circulation could have dramatic impacts in coming decades.
My name is Stefan Rahmstorff. I'm head of department at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. And I study the Atlantic Ocean overturning circulation.
The current that brings warm water to the north of the Atlantic and warms the northern hemisphere and particularly Europe.
Yes, this is the big heating system for Europe because it releases huge amounts of heat out of the ocean into the atmosphere in the northern Atlantic, which then warms Europe.
So we were talking to you, I guess, a couple of years ago, the last time we spoke to you, and your concern is that the changes in the climate because of global warming are going to stop that happening, which will have big climatic effects. You were just bringing us up to date with your latest results.
We know this current is weakening, and this is the reason why there is already a cooling in the northern Atlantic sea surface temperatures. It's not over land yet, but it's already affecting our weather to some extent. And there is a prediction by climate models that it will weaken further. And we know there is a tipping point that it could cross where it then essentially collapses, so that this heat transport, heat release off to the west of Britain stops. And that would have a massive impact, not only on European climate, but around the world.
I mean, I saw that you've now taken these projections beyond the year 2100, which is where things look quite dramatic.
Yes, the IPCC has said that it's unlikely that this current will collapse by 2100, but some of the model runs have been extended beyond the year 2100, and quite a few of those actually do show the current collapses, especially all of those for high emissions.
There's a key word that you've used, tipping point. As I understand it, this is not like putting your foot on the accelerator or taking it off. If this collapses, you can't just sort of restart it again, this current.
Exactly. A tipping point is more like when you lean back on your chair and you lean back too much up to a point, then it tips over and you can't do anything about it anymore. And we fear that the tipping point will actually already be crossed in the next few decades by the middle of this century. And then it becomes inevitable that the further collapse basically unfolds over the next 50 to 100 years.
Okay, you're saying that you can see that this circulation is weaker now than it was, say, 100 years ago, and that
yes.
Already seems inevitable. And this is a slow process, so even if it started, it's not that you expect all the impacts to be visible tomorrow.
That's right, it's not happening within 10 years or a few weeks, like in that movie The Day After Tomorrow. It unwinds slowly, but it then is inevitable and it will really change the face of Europe.
Suppose what I'm wondering is, when is that point of no return that you're talking about?
That's the billion-dollar question. We don't know where this point of no return is, this tipping point, but we used to think it is very unlikely to cross it this century. Now the more recent results suggest that that was too optimistic, and actually we are on track to cross it already in the next 20, 30 years or so if we don't rapidly reduce global emissions.
It's not just that Europe would cool down because of the loss of this transported heat, but that actually the weather systems change, which I think is probably much more important to people.
We will be seeing extremes that we haven't seen before. The sea level will rise by an additional meter around the North Atlantic, in addition to the global sea level rise that we're also witnessing. The tropical rainfall belts will shift to the south so that the tropical rainfall is not where it used to be, which is really bad for like rainforests. And then the tropical rainfall will be elsewhere where people are not used to it. The drainage systems are not used to it, so that will cause problems with flooding. So this is really, in Earth history, we have seen similar things happen during the last ice age, and those are the most dramatic climate changes that we know from paleoclimate that can unfold over a question of decades.
It is very apocalyptic. We've spoken to you about it before. With these new models, one, are you more certain than you were before that this could happen? I'm not quite even sure how to phrase this, because it's still a hypothesis in a sense, and recognizing the detail of our approach to this seems to be incredibly important.
Yeah, it is a risk, and we used to consider it a low probability, high impact risk, so like less than 10% chance of this happening. But because the impact would be so severe, we need to take it very seriously. Now we don't consider it low probability anymore, unfortunately. I would say it's like almost 50-50 that we will reach this tipping point in the next decades, depending on what we do to emissions.
And last of all, we did speak recently to a team who have a different view from the Met Office in the UK, and they're saying that there are outside influences which will moderate or could moderate the kinds of processes you're talking about. They discussed that here at this conference as well. What's the source of this difference of opinion? Is there a way of, is there some intermediate ground somewhere? Or how do you resolve that?
There's more a difference in terminology here. There's not really a difference in climate impacts. They are the same models these people are using, and they're just pointing out that this overturning circulation will not go to completely to zero in what we call a collapse, but the climate impact is the same. It will become very weak, very shallow, not reach so far north. So that heat release that warms Europe, and that what you are talking about, that will still basically collapse, even though the overturning in the ocean doesn't completely vanish, it just greatly weakens.
Stefan, thank you very much indeed. Stefan Ramsdorf, reinforcing concerns of an Atlantic tipping point sometime in the next few decades.
That was Stefan Ramsdorf in conversation with the BBC's Roland Peace at the May 1st conference in Vienna. Well, there you have it. More oddities in a changed world. At some point, Europe could have some bone-chilling cold winters, even while the rest of the world sweats it out. Hot, hot, hot. Remember, even during times of humans against humans, nature is the real power here, and nature always wins. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
In advance, in a world of chaos we cannot see, we turn to machines, begging on our knees, artificial savior, when will you save us? Deus ex machina, fear and hunger in our eyes, the world's a battleground.
This is Bird Note. Crested auklets are small seabirds that nest on remote cliffs in the northern Pacific and the Bering Sea. But it's their smell that really sets these birds apart. They smell like tangerines. Native peoples of the Bering Sea Islands have known about this for a long time, but for some reason, early European and American naturalists who carefully described the region's wildlife in every other way never commented on the bird's distinctive odor. Now that whiff of citrus on the salt air has become big news in the study of birds. That's because the scent, which is only produced during the breeding season, is a rare example of a bird producing an odor to entice mates. The female inspects a potential mate by pushing her beak into a male's neck feathers, where his special scent is concentrated. It appears to be a crucial sniff test. Field experiments show that females go for males who emit the strongest scents. Scientists think this scent could have other purposes too. The birds give off the odor more strongly when they're stressed. And the smell seems to also help keep parasites away. For a long time, scientists thought that most birds didn't rely much on their sense of smell at all. But over the last few decades, that's changing. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.